week of October 7th, 2018. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 426, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on the Upper West Side, near Lincoln Center, the original site of the fight between the Sharks and the Jets, I'm Michael Giltz. Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good, if I can wait. But you'll have to wait, too, because I am not going to be starring as Tony in West Side Story, directed by Steven Spielberg, because he went with Ansel Elgort.
Really?
It came down to the two of us. So close. But they decided they were going to go with someone younger and taller and better looking. You know, the commercial choice.
Yeah, I wanted to see the non-commercial choice.
Exactly. Me. So, we've been off for 2 weeks and I had that bad news. But then I had great news because, you know, I love Banksy. I love him so much. And there was an auction at Sotheby's. So I rolled my pennies and nickels and dimes and quarters. And I bid and I won. I won a piece of Banksy artwork. $1.04 million worth every penny. I love Banksy. I finally got a piece of Banksy of my own.
And now, literally, you have just a piece of Banksy. Just a piece. not the whole thing. Just a piece.
I love this. He had a shredder. Nobody knew, not even Sotheby's, that he had a shredder built into the frame displaying his piece of art. Someone buys it. They hold up their paddle. They spend $1 million. And everybody watches in horror as the artwork comes slowly shredded down through the bottom of the frame and falls onto the floor. Oh, my God. That was hilarious. And then the best part is, art experts go, you know what? I think he's just increased the value of that piece of art.
Can I tell you something? I was watching that in Brazil, of all places, and I thought to myself, no, just keep letting, because of course the Sotheby's was like, oh my God, stop it, unplug it, do something. They were trying to figure out like how this could possibly happen. And I said, no, just let it keep going, because every single centimeter that it goes through that shredder, it becomes more valuable.
Well, you're right on top with the art experts, so who knew? But yeah, I thought that is my favorite thing of the week until on Sunday I got to watch Jodie Whittaker of Broadchurch be the new doctor in Doctor Who. Very awesome, very fun. I thought she gave a great first performance. I thought she was charming and appealing, much better than Peter Capaldi. And I didn't know this, but she's named after Jodie Foster, which she's only 36. She's 36 years old. She's not like 12. So that must really make Jodie Foster feel old, because let's face it, Doctor Who is like 800 years old or something like that.
Oh, that's very funny. Yeah, I think that's true, actually, now that you mention it. It was the 60s, right? Or was it the 50s?
Oh, the show is like 60 plus years old. The show is older than both of them, but I think Jodie Foster's like 50 something.
Right.
But the doctor themselves is of indeterminate age. Oh. The doctor probably doesn't even really know, but 300, 800, couple thousand years, it varies wildly depending on which season you're looking at.
I see.
And the length of this show varies wildly depending on which season you're looking at. You just got back, of course, from Brazil.
That's right.
That's great. I hope you had fun. And you did a panel in
at the Geneva Convention in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And then I flew off to Brazil for Expo Cine, another cinema trade show.
And you met all our fans there. You were besieged by fans, I'm sure.
Yes. And then I realized, oh, there's an election in Brazil and the candidate is standing behind me. Well, okay.
So it wasn't actually Showbiz Sandbox fans. But you did meet some, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yes. Especially at the Geneva Convention.
Very cool. And we'll hear more next week about your panel, perhaps, on movie subscription services. But that went well. You were the moderator.
Yes, I was. And it did go well. It was a packed audience.
And you were brilliant as the moderator.
Pretty much, yes. I broke my hand patting myself on the back.
Well, and now you're going to moderate our episode. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, as you mentioned, Michael, we have 2 weeks of fun to catch up on. The September box office almost set a record, and October is off to a great start as well. Thank you, Venom. We have Venom to thank for that. In China news, Fan Bingbing is back. She feels really, really bad, by the way, about the whole dual contract tatch dodge thing, especially since her manager is still in the custody of Chinese authorities. Meanwhile, production of Chinese movies and TV shows has ground to a halt while everyone gets on the phone with their lawyers so they can restructure deals and pay some back taxes that may or may not have slipped their minds. Plus, the U.S. share of the China box office has taken a tumble, even as overall box office rises. So we have a whole lot of China news. In Book Filter news, it was Super Thursday in the U.K. on October 4th, when more than 500 books came out at the same time. And Michael not only read all of them, he will name them all, just one at a time. Just kidding. So much happened in sexual misconduct news during the last 2 weeks that it's our main feature. It is? I did not know that. Bill Cosby goes to jail. CBS does some house cleaning. Matthew Weiner admits it's not impossible he made a harassing comment or two to a female employee. And Louis C.K. does another set at the Comedy Cellar. On Inside Baseball, we've got a roundup of music news from three different acts topping the Billboard album charts to the RIAA making, like the Oscars, and inviting a bunch of new members. Me too, they said, but in a good way. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also have information pulled from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, you, our listener. And the number one movie around the world is the Spider-Man villain Venom, starring Tom Hardy. Got off to a great start, $205 million worldwide, a lot of money for a movie that cost maybe $100, $110 million to make. And Sony, in the grand tradition of Warner Brothers, apparently, is going to make a lot of superhero movies that nobody likes, but actually make money.
Yeah, I can tell you, Sony right now is breathing a huge sigh of relief.
Yeah, we'll have to, I mean, but their desire to make tons of spinoffs and franchises, oy, you know, let's make a good movie first.
Right. Well, that's why, you know, they were wondering, well, since we made a bad movie, we wonder if anybody wants to see this character anyway. And then the movie's not good.
And someday, Tom Hardy will learn how to enunciate.
He does so with his eyes. I don't know if you've noticed that. With both Bane, right, in the mm-hmm. Batman movie, and then in the Christopher Nolan movie, Dunkirk, he only had his eyes to act with. And he did a great job.
Well, Warner Brothers did a great job with A Star Is Born. Excellent reviews, excellent opening weekend, $55 million worldwide, a sold-out Academy screening, so lots of Oscar buzz for this movie, the fourth in the reboot remaking of this classic tale. People went crazy for it. You know, excellent opening. Yes, Venom made about twice as much money, but A Star Is Born is going to have legs. This is going to run for months through the Oscar season. So they are going to have a great multiple, meaning they opened up to about $42 million in North America. They're going to quadruple that, I think, before all is said and done. I think the sky's the limit because the soundtrack is doing well. The movie got great reviews. My mom went to see it and liked it, you know. So when that's happening, when you get young people, middle-aged, older people, the four quadrants, right? That's what they call it. I think this movie is going to hit that.
Yes, I agree. And I don't think we should say it will have legs just because Lady Gaga is tall, you know, doesn't mean.
I was thinking of Bradley Cooper's legs.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind.
At number three is Project Gutenberg, which brings us over to Hong Kong and China. That was on October 10th coming up is, well, depending on when you listen to this podcast, is National Day. Or the double 10 day, because it's 10-10, October 10th. And it's a celebration of, it's sort of like our 4th of July, sort of. Taiwan celebrates it a lot. China celebrates it for different reasons, obviously. But it is a big national holiday. Lots of movies start coming up within a week or two, even before it happens. And that's why we got a lot of big Hong Kong and Chinese movies opening up. Project Gutenberg is one of them. It's an action film starring the legendary Chow Yun-fat. It grossed $38 million this weekend. It's at $100 million worldwide. And when you look down to follow the other Chinese films, Shadow at number five. That's the new film directed by Zhang Yimou. It's a historical drama. It looks like it's going to be Chinese Oscar hopeful rather than Dying to Survive, that drug smuggling movie that we thought would be their Oscar nominee. It got a lot of Golden Horse nominations, which is their Oscars in a way. In fact, all the movies nominated for Best Picture are from Chinese mainland directors, and that hasn't happened in a long time. But Shadow opened up a couple weekends ago. It's at $18 million this weekend and a total of $65 million. So you can see we're catching up on movies that have been out for a week or two. This is all leading up around the hubbub of 10-10 Day. Same thing for Hello, Mrs. Money. That's a Chinese romantic comedy. It stars Selena Jade, who broke out in Wolf Warrior 2. Now she's a lead character in this movie. $15 million on the weekend. That's at $75 million total and counting. And I think there might be one more movie. Let me see. No, that's a Korean movie. Scrolling down through the charts. Oh, yes. Fat Buddies. That's the movie Sperling and I are going to do the English language remake of. Fat Buddies is a Chinese action comedy directed and starring Bao Bier. I'm not sure how to say his last name, but he's a well-known Chinese actor. Very large. $8 million on this weekend. It's made about $30 million so far in all.
And I only agreed to do it because I would be allowed to eat anything for at least 3 months.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we got a lot of work to do to catch up with the two leads in that movie. There's still more Chinese films. Lost Found is a Chinese drama. I couldn't really figure out what it was about. I think it opened this weekend. Its total is $8.2 million. And then there's another movie that's been out for a few weeks. It's called Cry Me a Sad River. It's a teen drama based on the novel by Edward Gua, who is, of course, a guy we've talked about before. He's a teen idol, a pop star, a screenwriter, a businessman, an entrepreneur. He's kind of like the Iron Man of China. He's somewhat controversial in terms of, you know, being more out there and outspoken on public issues. He wrote this novel. They've turned it into a film, but they've also made a TV series out of it, a 52-part TV series, which is just about to debut on television. This drama is a tearjerker, and it's made $45 million so far. It looks like it's a little bit about bullying, from what I can tell. But I think those are all the big Chinese dramas that we could track down. So,
well, and those last two were at number 15 and 16.
Yeah, so way down on the chart. Yeah. So a lot of stuff happened at the Chinese box office. We needed to catch up, and there you are. When we come back to the worldwide box office, we're back at number 4. That's Smallfoot, the animated film with the voices of Channing Tatum, among others. $26 million on the weekend. That's at $75 million worldwide. So not great reviews. Sort of, you know, people are like, it's okay. It cost about $80 million to make, and it's just matched that. But it's got a ways to go, and it is a family film, so we'll have to see where they end up. But right now, they've just matched their box office. At number 6 is a movie I haven't seen. It's Night School with Tiffany Haddish and Kevin Hart. $15 million on the weekend, $60 million worldwide. So that's doubled its reported budget. And Kevin Hart, oh, God, he's in that horrible French film, The Indescribables, or whatever that awful racist
Untouchables.
Movie was.
The Untouchables.
Oh, it made an English language remake with him and Bryan Cranston. It's called The Upside, I think. Our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, made me watch the trailer, and I threw up in my mouth. It looks so offensively, you know, sentimental and heart-tugging, and it just looked awful. You just wanted to...
Made a mint in France. I think it might even
be... All over the world. It made a ton of money. Yeah, no, the Untouchables made a ton of money. We'll have to see if they pull off the same trick. You know, certainly Bryan Cranston's a good actor, and Kevin Hart has pull. I'm sure it'll make money, but...
Well, number 6 anyway. Was Night School. Number 7 is that Hello, Mrs. Money from China.
That's right. And number 8 is Johnny English Strikes Again, another $14 million for the Rowan Atkinson Bond spoof. That's at $66 million worldwide. Jack Black and Cate Blanchett, is that who it is? Yes. They are in A House with a Clock in Its Walls. That's at $90 million worldwide. And at number 10 in the worldwide box office chart is The Nun, another $10 million in the number 10 position. That's just about going to hit $350 million worldwide and continue going on. So, I mean, the end is not seen. $375 million, $400 million, I don't know. But another $10 million for The Nun, and that's at $350 million worldwide. The Conjuring franchise just continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger. I've never seen any of them. Have you?
No, I have not. I'm not a big horror fan at all. It made, $9.8 million this weekend?
Right. I rounded it up to $10
million. Okay. And so that's what you'd need to do to break into the top 10. In Brazil, this movie has taken off. And it, by the way, has taken off as well. So all of these Conjuring movies have done well.
Oh, very, very
horror films in general do well in Latin America.
Well, there you go. At number 11 worldwide is a Korean drama. This is our first Korean film, I think, on the charts. Dark Figure of Crime. It made $9 million on its opening weekend. That's where we're at. And it's based on a true story that took place in Busan. And it's about murders that were never reported, bodies that were never found, and investigations that never happened. Like, what? But apparently, dark figure of crime is a term of art in police work where they talk about those crimes that go unreported or undiscovered. A good example would be sexual assault, or, you know, a sexual harassment or sexual assault done perhaps by a Supreme Court nominee. And that is often unreported, or violence, domestic violence often goes unreported. But sometimes people get killed and somehow it never gets reported. There was a TV episode in a sort of a TV docuseries, I guess it's sort of like not Cops, but maybe America's Most Wanted, that was aired in Korea talking about this case. And the screenwriter saw that, got fascinated, interviewed the cop who was involved in the actual real case, and wrote the screenplay over 5 years. And now we have a film about it. So it's about unreported crimes and how that can happen. It sounds like a very good reviews for this sort of psychological thriller. Sounds like a movie that would be ripe for Hollywood remake. So $9 million on the weekend. It sounds very interesting. You know, and if you've seen this or know about the real story, hey, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And we are on Facebook, where you can like us, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That's right. That was at number 11. At number 12 is Fat Buddies, that Chinese action comedy. At number 13 is the Anna Kendrick comedy. Will we call it a comedy? A Simple Favor. $7 million on the weekend. $77 million worldwide. So that has been a big success story, and it's still pushing along. And that's going to have a great afterlife on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming, because everyone who sees this movie likes it.
Yes, I am among them.
That's right. At number 14 is The Incredibles 2, chugging along, making more money. 15 is that Chinese drama, Lost Found. At number 16 is that other Chinese drama, Cry Me a Sad River. At number 17 is a sequel. It's Aladdin 2. It's kind of a weird spelling, but it's basically Aladdin 2. You know Aladdin, the famous boy and the lamp story. Well, The New Adventures of Aladdin came out a few years ago in France, starring Kev Adams, and this is the sequel. The first one made money. The new one has come out. It's a broad comedy, and it's made about $5 million on its opening weekend. Disney's Christopher Robin, Disney knows something about Aladdin, having turned it into movies and Broadway shows and straight to DVD spinoffs.
And now
they have a live action film in the works. That's right. They're going to crush that Aladdin, that's for sure. But they've also got Disney's Christopher Robin. That film made another $4 million on the weekend. It's at $180 million worldwide. So despite middling reviews, despite not getting a release in China, this Ewan McGregor drama has tripled its reported budget, so Disney's Christopher Robin is going to be just fine. And number 19 is Crazy Rich Asians, another $3 million on the weekend, $225 million worldwide. And as I've said before, boy, was I wrong about this movie. I never would have imagined most of the money it made would be in North America. I thought it could be a hit here, but I thought the real honeypot was going to be in Asia. But that hasn't turned out to be the case. $170 million in North America, $56 million in the rest of the world. So this really is a hit made in America, in every sense of the word. And I mean that in a positive sense, that they've embraced this English language film, to be fair. But this film set in Asia was starring an all Asian cast. So that's great news.
You know, Awkwafina, who stars in Crazy Rich Asians, she's one of the supporting cast members.
Yes.
She was the host of Saturday Night Live. And she made a point of saying that, you know, Lucy Liu had hosted Saturday Night Live when she was very young, and she always looked up to Lucy Liu. And now another Asian American woman is hosting Saturday Night Live. But she said, though she starred in Crazy Rich Asians, she is not a Crazy Rich Asian. She's more like a restoring your credit score rich Asian.
Well, and up next, perhaps on Saturday Night Live, will be Sandra Oh. Overdue to be a guest host. Well, I'm just saying, why not? She's got another season of Killing Eve coming out in 2019. I'll bet they get her to host the show pegged to that.
Yeah, why not?
Absolutely. At number 20 is The Adventure of Afanti. I haven't a clue what country this is from. what it's about or anything. I tried to look it up. No success. But it opened, I guess, last weekend. It's at $10 million worldwide. We already gave you the info. So if you know anything about it, let us know so we can catch up and figure out what it is. The Met had a live performance of Aida that went out worldwide in one of those, you know, pay-per-view specials where you go to the movie theater and watch the opera. $3.2 million worldwide. So that's the exciting box office. If you wanted to get on the chart at all, you had to make about $2 million. And if you know about a movie anywhere in the world that grossed $2 million and it's not on our list, you can always check our show notes. Let us know so we can make sure we catch up with that. But there is some sad news in the North American box office. The Hate U Give opened up. This is a film adaptation of a young adult novel about hate crimes. And the screenwriter is Audrey Wells. And she died at 58 the day before the film came out. She directed a couple movies. She wrote scripts for films like The Truth About Cats and Dogs, George of the Jungle. So a bittersweet weekend for her family and friends. The Hollywood season in general did good, right? September turned out pretty darn well, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, there would have liked it to make a few more dollars, but it's not a, you know, the biggest of all time. But look, you know what? It's the second biggest of all time. Last year, $700 million, if you want to round up by $1 million, which was the number one September of all time. Thank you, It, by the way. I think It made like $286 million all by itself.
And what did we make this September?
What did we make this September? I think it was just under, wasn't it?
Well, it was about $660 million. So it was $40 million off setting a record. One more film, I guess. One more modest hit film opening weekend. So it came very close. But again, people are yelling and screaming about the U.S. box office, the North American box office, the worldwide box office. But we have month after month setting new records when you look at the expansion of the year to 12 months out of the year. It does mean, you know, June and July we'll slow down a bit, and maybe November and December, because you've got movies opening up in January and February and March and April and August and September like you never had before. You know, the distributors have been complaining for decades. Look, release movies 12 months of the year. People still go to the movies happily in September. And now you can see this. In 2015, we had the biggest September of all time. In 2017, we had the biggest September of all time, topping that. In 2018, we almost did it again. And in fact, with the range of movies that were hits, it was an even better September in some ways than last year because you had a lot more movies benefiting. So this is great news for everybody. It's the story of the entire calendar year. It's the story of the expansion of the box office to every month of the year. And now October's gotten off to a great start as well.
Yeah, and one of the things that I see going to these conferences, you know, and I go to many of them, I'm going to Show East in a couple of weeks, is that, yes, you're making more money. What they're trying to do now is get more people because, you know, at least in certain countries, Brazil being one of them, and certainly the U.S., where it's kind of some years it's up just slightly, and some years it's down slightly. It's kind of a plateau effect.
Well, it's a mature business. We're not going to suddenly double the box office the way you will in China by adding new screens. Right. We've got all the screens we need. People have a million other ways to see movies, and they make tons of money that way. We make more money after a movie leaves the box office than we do when they're in the box office.
Mind you, keep in mind, when I'm at a cinema trade show, okay?
They don't care about any of that.
Exactly. Exactly. They're like, congratulations, you made $25 billion this year.
Lower the prices of your popcorn and soda. I'm serious. It's ridiculous. You know, it's unhealthy and it's too expensive. That's really makes it really easy for me to say no. If it was unhealthy and tasty and it wasn't so expensive, I would be more likely every once in a while to say, okay. But it's truly absurd. They give you a tankard of soda that's so big you can barely hold it, a mountain of popcorn, and they charge you more than the ticket to the movie. It just, what are they thinking? I know that's where their profits come from, but you know, the short-term benefit of the higher prices, you know, it's the same thing with ticket prices. You lower the ticket price a little bit, people might go more often. And if you head to the Middle Kingdom, if you head to China, you can see that a box office is flourishing there, but Hollywood is not always benefiting. I have to tell you, I heard the headline and it said Hollywood box office share of China's box office has gone down. And I thought, well, okay, but maybe the entire box office has grown. So maybe Hollywood's making more money, but it's just other people are making even more money because it's grown so much. But it turns out that's not the case, is it?
No, they're actually the amount of money that Hollywood films are making is going down. And that's because there are more. Well, there's a couple reasons for that. Okay. There's, you know, some bit of a, you know, economic slowdown. Now, mind you, okay, so they're not growing as fast, basically.
Well, what are the numbers? What are the numbers?
Well, I guess what? It was down $500 million in real dollars, $2.17 billion in 2017 after three quarters. That's how much money Hollywood movies had made. And they're at $1.64 billion in 2018.
So in the first three quarters of this year, we've made $500 million less, talking about Hollywood, than they made last year. So that's a big jump down. That's a big fall down, of course. But let's keep in mind that it is 1 year. So let's not freak out over 1 year's drop. There could be lots of reasons. You know, maybe multiple movies were blocked or they're being held for another quarter or whatever. But, you know, you don't want to jump to too many conclusions from 1 year compared to the next. You want to look at the trend overall. The trend overall is the Chinese box office is growing a lot and Hollywood movies are proving profitable there.
Yeah. Now, what you hear from, especially when you go to these international trade shows, is that all of these movie theaters are being built in China. And, you know, of course, all of these manufacturers of, you know, whether it's 3D, you know, technology or projectors or point of sale systems.
We'll shake the seats and spray you with water.
Right. they're saying, look, a lot of these theaters are being built in these second and third tier markets and they are 100% empty. Like nobody's going to them.
Well, because the theaters aren't well built or they're in a market that's not big enough?
Probably the latter. Or frankly, you know, you built a cinema in a place where nobody can afford to go. So,
right. If you're going to charge the same price as the big city, obviously they have slightly lower prices in the provinces.
Right. Correct. And, but still it's like, you know, they're not used to doing it. They're more rural markets and they're just half of the seats are empty, if not more.
So why did they build a theater in an area that doesn't have enough? I mean, we know that like over, I think 2/3 of China is still scrabbling by day to day. There's a huge middle class. This is as big as the entire U.S. population, but there are hundreds of millions of people in China, as in India, that are on barely subsistence level. So they are not going to the movies for sure.
Correct. And so, you know, you're right. When you're talking scales of India, scales of China, you got 1.4 billion people in China. Okay. So when you're talking at the number one hit show, television show, it's
80 million, 100 million.
Yeah, yes. 600 million people are watching this show, right? Literally. I mean, that's more people than you live in the US and Canada combined. So to answer your question about why are these theaters empty, there could be any multitude of reasons that, you know, the government is asking for these theaters to be built in shopping malls or they're asking for these theaters to be built. The companies are complying. And you know what? There's just no market for it.
Yet.
Oh, yeah. That very well might be the case.
So there are 10,000 screens in China.
No. They have as many, if not more, screens than the U.S.
Oh, I thought theaters. I mean, 10,000 theaters.
Oh, that very well might be true. Yes.
Yeah, I think they're at about 10,000 theaters now. So they've got more capacity than they need. So that doesn't explain any issue why Hollywood box office would drop from, you know, this year to last year.
No, but it could be one movie. You know, Solo didn't do well in the U.S.
Half a billion dollars. Yeah. That's not one movie.
Yeah, correct.
All right. Well, one happy news in China, Fan Bing Bing is back.
Right. Now, this is one of those things that is happening more and more in China, not just in the entertainment sector, but as we found out over the weekend with people like the head of Interpol.
Just
go missing, you know.
And let's not assume that's a case of, you know, actual valid corruption or criminal acts by the person involved. That might just be political.
Correct. And this was, right, you know, obviously both political and corruption.
Well, they were making a point on Fan Bing Bing, but she, assuming perhaps it's true, she may have broken the law and therefore, you know.
Right. So just to catch people up, Fan Bing Bing, huge star in China and the world. She's a movie star. And in China, they had this two-contract policy. One contract was written and you got paid a certain amount. It was the contract that you showed to the government and that's what you paid taxes on. Then there was a second contract that was written for the true and much higher amount that you were paid, which you didn't show to the government and for which you actually got paid. And the government found out about this, kind of through a talk show host of all people. And guess what? The government said, hey, we actually want to know the truth here. Fan, why don't you come in for questioning? I mean, we're going to hold you for the next like 5 months and nobody's going to know where you are for 5 months. And then we will only let you out and release you due to international pressure. But still, we'll get to the bottom of this.
I don't know that they released her because of international pressure. I think they released her because they were done with their investigation. Due process got nothing to do with it. And I don't think there was enough international pressure to make them care. I don't think that's it at all. I think they just finished what they wanted. They made an example of her. She released a public statement saying, I failed my country, which nurtured me. I failed the society, which trusted me. I failed the fans who liked me. And she says, I totally accepted all of them, meaning the fines, and will raise funds to pay my taxes and penalties regardless of any obstacles. So, I mean, maybe they'll let her rehabilitate herself. This is not, you know, she may have cheated the law, in which case that's wrong. But this is not a country where you have due process. So, you know, you hate to jump to any conclusions, but let's take it at face value. She broke the law. The government's making her pay taxes that she should have paid in the first place. And they have a history of cracking down on wealthy celebrities. And this is the latest example.
Now, just to give you some sense as to the tax bill, a $70 million tax bill. Okay. Do you know that, like, Tom Cruise might have trouble raising $70 million for a tax. He might not owe $70 million in taxes even in the U.S. So apparently, they're saying, how much money did you make? Yeah, that's ours now.
Yeah. So she can pay the fine and apparently will probably not be put on trial or go to jail. That's reportedly. Her manager, however, remains in custody. So that's scary. And suddenly we hear a lot of Chinese stars are calling up their accountants and going, oh my gosh, I forgot to pay my taxes.
Yeah.
Let's get that done. And it really is having an effect on production as well, isn't it?
Well, because of course, while that's being done, you can't pay anybody. Right. And all of
these
deals
have to redo all their contracts.
Right. All the deals have to be rewritten so that it's like, instead of two contracts, you'll only get one. And here's the taxes that you'll pay on it.
That's right. I thought this was interesting as well. There is a new Chinese law that might curtail the streaming of non-Chinese TV and film shows. So they've always had sort of rules and restrictions in general on on streaming services. There has always been a rule that like 30% of your content is the maximum amount you can have of international stuff. So if you offer a streaming service in China, at least 70% of it must be Chinese content. So that's been in place for a while. But now they're putting out these new rules for people to mention and discuss. And they may say, all right, you can only have 30% international content in every category. There's no category in which you can add extra. So like maybe in Marvel superhero movies, you had a ton of foreign content. And then in educational films that nobody actually watched, you threw in a bunch of Chinese content to figure out the balance and said, oh, we're covered. We matched the proper quota. No more. If you've got a section for superhero movies, only 30% of it can be international content. That's a new proposed rule.
But China's not alone on this. I mean, there are countries that have this rule. France has it. Brazil has it in the cinema. You know, 20 to 30%. I think it's 20% has to be local content.
But do they have that on streaming services?
If they don't now, they will.
Yeah. So on streaming, they're going to have a book, a catalog. And they're going to say, all right, these are the approved shows that you can have from around the world. If they're not in the book, you can't stream them. So everybody's going to want to get in that book. That may actually be a plus, I think. They've never done that before, but there's so much confusion as to what's allowed and what's not allowed. Maybe that will be a positive. Who knows? I'm just fantasizing there. But on TV, similar stuff. You're going to be limited to 30% of overseas content in every category. You can't show anything in prime time without approval. So these new rules are up there. It could disrupt international production. I'm going to guess by the time it's all is said and done, it'll be sort of business as usual. Because like you say, they've been probably following a lot of this already in the first place.
Correct. Now, I don't want to say every show, but on most shows, we have a little section we like to call reboots, remakes. I guess it's just reboots and remakes, right?
Well, also whatever. Yeah, you name it. Reboots. But there's something else. What's the other flavor? Reboots, remakes, and reimaginings. Who knows?
Adaptations, because our first one is an adaptation of Almost Famous, the movie. Of course, Cameron Crowe wrote and directed that film. Kate Hudson starred in it, and it's going to be turned into a musical.
It's a seriously well along the way. That's why we're including it. Cameron Crowe is going to do the book. The music is by Tom Kitt, and lyrics will be by Kitt and Crow. So it's going to be an original musical. It's going to have all original songs, though I think already it's going to be a disaster if they don't get the rights to Tiny Dancer.
Which played such a pivotal role in the film.
Yeah, You got to have that moment in the show. Otherwise, it'll be a bummer because that doesn't work with an original song. So I'm hoping that'll happen. I'm not sure what to think about High Fidelity, the TV series. Maybe they'll set it in the past. It's a TV show set around a record store. I guess they still exist. But this is funny. Zoe Kravitz will be starring in the TV show. She's actually taking over the John Cusack role. And I guess, you know what, vinyl is still a thing. But the funny thing is she's the daughter of Lenny Kravitz and Lisa Bonet, who played John Cusack's girlfriend in the movie. So the daughter is taking over the role of the boyfriend dating her mother in the film.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So 10 episodes for the new Disney streaming service, High Fidelity, the TV series. It's record stores. It's cool. It can work. I think it will be far afield of the original novel, but that's okay.
What about The Wild Bunch being, I guess it's being remade by Mel Gibson. You know, who, by the way, you know, who says you can't get second chances? In fact, this film is going to star Kevin Spacey. I'm just kidding.
I mean, it's co-written and directed by Mel Gibson. This movie really doesn't need to be remade. This movie is a great film because of what it is and how it was made and who made it, Sam Peckinpah and the people in it. It is not as such something like Robin Hood that you need to remake again and again. It sounds like an awful idea. I'm not looking forward to it. Oof.
Well, there were 500 books released last week in the UK. I want to know which ones you are looking forward to, which ones you've read, which brings us to our Book Filter segment. And Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And every week you bring us, well, a few books that are kind of ready for their adaptation. Over on the site, you have all the books that are published and which ones people should be reading. But here at Showbiz Sandbox, you have like, you know, a couple that, you know, it could be adapted to movies or television shows.
That's right. And it was Super Thursday in London. You've got the fall book season. And in North America, we have Black Friday. But Super Thursday is not the day where people swarm into the bookstores or stores to shop, though I'm sure, you know, serious book lovers do. And there's 500 new books came out this week, you know, on October 4th, I should say. But it is a day where all those books get into the store so they can be ready for the big holiday season, just as a lot of books come out in the fall before Black Friday. After Black Friday, which is the day after Thanksgiving in North America, which is late in November, end of November, December, very few books come out. They're all in the stores because they know people are going to be shopping for the holidays right away, and they want to have those books in place so that when people show up, they're already there. So you're not going to release a big book necessarily December 12th. Okay. Doesn't make any sense. So a similar thing happens in the UK. It's not pegged to a particular day where people swarm the stores, but it is the day where they say, let's get those books in there because everyone's going to be shopping for the holidays. So 500 books hit the stores on Super Thursday, October 4th in the UK. And the books are by Tina Turner, Eric Idle, Jacqueline Wilson, David Attenborough, Michael Caine, Melmoth by Sarah. I'm going to name every single book. Is that okay?
Yeah. No, actually, we should probably just get to the one that we should be reading. And by the way, none of those are authors. They're all like actors or musicians. Or
there were a lot of celeb books and a lot of celeb biographies came out. Jacqueline Wilson is a mystery author.
Right.
David Attenborough, you know, so that is a light mystery. Sarah Perry had a big hit with The Essex Serpent. That did well in North America as well. Her new gothic novel, Melmoth, came out in the UK and is coming out here in the US like this week or very soon. So there are a lot of authors mixed in. 500 books, couldn't cover them all, but lots of celebs with their celeb bios hit the stores as well. Here in North America this week, I have a pick. I've done it for the third time now. This is a book called Wrecked by Joe Ide. God, I should look up his name, how to spell it. I apologize, Joe. But it's the third in a series set in LA starring IQ. A sort of hip-hop, new generation Sherlock Holmes. Terrific books. I've talked about the first two. As far as I can tell, this series has still not been optioned for movies or TV. Go figure. But it's a fun mystery, great reviews. I haven't read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And you should check it out.
Well, I think you know how to spell Joe Ide's name, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, but I think we need to know the pronunciation, whether it's Ide or Ide.
Yeah, forgot. You know, let us know. We've already told you the contact info.
That's right. But that brings us, unfortunately, to our sexual misconduct news. And I say unfortunately because it's sad that we still have to have sexual misconduct news.
And that's what I'd love to talk to you about first. You have a daughter, of course.
Yes.
And when you say it's sad that we have to talk about this, you wish sexual misconduct would disappear, that it didn't happen anymore. It would be nice if it didn't happen.
Correct. That's what I'm
right.
saying.
That's all you mean. And yet, of course, you know realistically that's not going to happen. We haven't solved the problem of racism. We're not going to wake up tomorrow and go, oh, racism, done.
Correct.
We're taking care of that. So that ain't going to happen in our lifetimes. So our choice is to ignore it and let it fester, or to talk about it and see changes happening and consequences are happening for people who are misbehaving. We saw Les Moonves removed from CBS, and then guess what? Suddenly, multiple people working on CBS shows or in the executive suites of CBS find themselves out of a job. What a shocker. When the guy who's sexually harassing and assaulting women is removed from power, they decide, maybe we should do some house cleaning. Those other people who were doing things that we're not happy about, now they are paying the consequence. So this isn't a sad thing that we're talking about it. It's really not. If we don't talk about it, it means we're ignoring it. And if we ignore it, that doesn't help.
Well, absolutely nobody ignored the sentencing, prison sentencing, of Bill Cosby, who was sentenced 3 to 10 years in a state prison for sexual assault.
Right. His lawyer says, come on, he's an old man, he's blind or partially blind or mostly blind. He's not a threat to anyone. Doesn't mean you don't have to go to prison, though, to face the punishment for your crimes. So it's ugly and sad, and yet it's a good day because someone who wrecked lives for decades is paying a price. It's awful and miserable for the women involved that they had to have their lives, you know, ruined and shadowed by Bill Cosby's success. And can you imagine being assaulted by that guy and then having to spend decades of hearing what a wonderful, beautiful family man he is? I mean, what a nightmare for them.
And then, and then last week, during the or 2 weeks ago, during the Supreme Court hearings of Brett Kavanaugh, he was used to invoke evilness. His
name. Bill Cosby. Well, yeah. Of course, yes. He spent decades destroying people's lives. Yeah. Yes. So it's an ugly day. His work will survive him, I think, as valuable and worth watching and listening to and perhaps enjoying once you can put all that behind you. But, you know, Bill Cosby, the person, is in jail, and that's a good thing.
Well, and I guess you already mentioned the stuff from CBS. I don't know what else you want to talk about here. Matthew Weiner, we mentioned at the top of the show. I guess now he's saying, well, you know, I created Mad Men and the Romanoffs, but I don't remember telling writer Kater Gordon she owed it to him to, you know, let him see her naked, but, you know, I don't not remember it.
Yeah, he used to say, absolutely not. Now he says, well, it's not impossible.
Right.
So that's a hell of a change. So that's unpleasant and sad. But yeah, you know, so the new show getting a little mixed reviews. I'm not going to be... You know, sometimes people get built up so much, people love to tear them down. But I'm on the record as not having been a huge fan of Mad Men. You know, I liked the first season. I loved the actors. There were good parts of it, but I never was a big fan of the show. So I really, it looks like he was given a blank check and went crazy. And the Romanovs looks like a hot mess as far as I can tell.
We're now going to be stopping the world from spinning so that Michael can get off.
That's right. But yeah, so, you know, we'll have to check out that show. We'll have to see what's going on. But I mean, to name the people at CBS, we had talked before about Brad Kern, the NCIS New Orleans producer. Multiple investigations, multiple complaints. Finally, they did a third investigation. And now that Les Moonves is out of the way, he's gone. And that's a CBS Studios show. So it's their show that they own on their network. And former employees say, you know what, if Les Moonves was still there, he would still be working for them. Similarly, we have a CBS exec, Vinny Favalli. He's been placed on leave over charges of workplace misconduct. 9 current and former employees described the stuff that he has done. Perhaps the most important is that a woman complained about him to Human Resources, and she says her career suffered. And then finally, this is a show that CBS airs, but it's an ABC studio show. It's Criminal Minds, a big hit for CBS for a long time. And the DP on that show, Greg St. John's, has many, many complaints about physically fondling and harassing male staffers, firing anyone who complains, directors refusing to ever work on the show again because of his behavior, and complaints ignored for years by the studio. So Variety spoke to 19 current or former staffers with complaints, and people complained through proper channels. Nothing happened. And what the funny thing about this is, it's an ABC studio show, so you wouldn't think CBS's culture change would matter. But what I'm surprised is, he's the DP.
Right, like, I know. Like, who
the DP would be able to lord it over everybody? And he's not the showrunner. He's not the lead star. He's the DP. And I love directors of photography. They do great work. I admire them. I love interviewing them. But I've never thought of one as really being that much. Is the look of Criminal Minds so distinctive that that's the man on the show? That just struck me as bizarre.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what is he going to threaten you with? I'll make you look bad. Yeah, well, I won't light you well.
That will upset some actors. But some people who go to the Comedy Cellar don't want to see an act by Louis C.K. So Comedy Cellar has a new policy. Louis C.K. did drop in. He did another set unannounced, did not again address the issues about why he's been out of the spotlight. He was reportedly warmly received by the audience, and the club has a new policy. I don't know if they're dumb thinking about what they want to do, when, why, and how, but at least they said, look, if you show up to a show and an unannounced person appears and you don't want to watch their set, just get up and leave. We will pick up your check. No questions asked. You know, don't worry about it. Just quietly, you know, we ask that you quietly get up and leave, not make a scene, not yell, not scream. But like, you want to leave? Just leave. We'll pay your check. Don't worry about it. Which I think is at least a good step to take.
Yeah, well, then they're not forcing anybody to stay there while they wait for their check.
Well, it's not the waiting for the check.
I know, I'm just saying it's, they have a policy now, whereas before it was just like, you know.
Well, they've taken one step just to address concerns of audience members who maybe don't want to sit there when Bill Cosby gets out and wants to do a show.
Right.
And do it unannounced. Well, I don't know. I don't think it's a big deal, but I think it's a smart first step.
Whoa. You don't think that's a big deal, really? Okay, well, you know, if that's the case, then I wonder if any of the stories in our segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, will be to your fancy. In fact, it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, HBO, what have you wrought? Its success with Game of Thrones has turned fantasy into the hottest genre on television. Everyone wants their own Game of Thrones. First, Amazon won a massive bidding war to set multiple series in the fantasy world of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. Those shows, yes, more than one show, will be set slightly before or during the events of those books. Then Netflix joined the game by optioning all the C.S. Lewis novels set in Narnia. They'll make multiple films and TV shows out of those books. Then Amazon said, oh yeah, and they optioned the massive 14 volumes of the Wheel of Time fantasy by Robert Jordan. Big deal or big whoop?
I could talk for an hour about this. You know, when people say, what's the greatest fantasy TV show of all time? It's Game of Thrones, because there have been virtually no fantasy TV shows ever made. There are very few. You can probably count them on one hand, practically. So it's a genre that TV hasn't had the budget or ability to really tackle seriously. Now they do. That's exciting. It'll be fun to see. I'm confused by the Wheel of Time series. This is a huge bestseller, like 80 million copies worldwide. But its description really confuses me. They talk about how magic in this world can only be wielded by women. That is absolutely not the case in the books. And when you're developing the magic of a world, that's as fundamental as it gets in terms of what the story is about. You know, it matters what the magic is and who can do it and why and how and when. So unless they have completely changed the books, which doesn't even seem possible to me because they're so complex, unless they've utterly overwhelmed it, either the press release is wrong or they're doing something that is really going to tick off the fans of the books. Because man or woman, you don't want them dramatically changing the concept and the entire idea behind Wheel of Time. So I think that's just a mistake. I think they just messed up in how they described it. But who knows?
Well, now, MacArthur just announced its new genius grants. And yet again, I'd like to point out, Michael has been passed over.
So I feel like Bob Hope at the Oscars.
Yes, well, the recipients range from a civil rights leader to scientists working on theories about how the Earth and Moon were formed to a New York City choreographer. Among the other genius grants to the arts, poet Natalie Diaz of Arizona State University, violinist Vijay Gupta with the LA Philharmonic, painter Titus Kapar of New Haven, Connecticut, and playwright Dominique Morisot of New York. Big deal or big whoop?
The MacArthur brand is... Brandt? The MacArthur grant is always a big deal, always fun. Fun to see Dominique Morisot in the mix there because we both loved her play that we saw, and it's great to see her on there. So very cool. Great couple weeks for her. She's on the list of the most produced playwrights. She had one of the most produced plays of the year, and now she's got a genius grant. So good week for Dominique.
And of course, the play we're referring to is The Skeleton Crew.
Or just Skeleton Crew, that's right. And did you get my Oscar joke?
I did.
His famous, you know, he never, of course, got nominated, or I don't think he ever got nominated. He certainly never won an Oscar. Maybe they gave him a lifetime achievement just because he hosted it so many times. I'd have to look that up. But his big joke at one of the Oscars was, you know, it's welcome to the Oscars, the Academy Awards, as we call it in my house, Passover.
Right, exactly.
All right.
Boxing just took a knockout blow from HBO. The sport was once a signature draw for the pay TV channel, but those days are long gone. Many recent bouts have drawn less than 1 million viewers. Even a relatively key matchup barely passed 1 million viewers. But don't cry for boxing just yet. It is still flourishing on pay-per-view, where a core fan base can be cajoled into spending $50 a shot on an evening of fisticuffs. Toss in digital platform DAZN with a $10 a month fee, Showtime's increased fervor, and ESPN's new commitment to the sport with a 7-year deal, tying it to Top Rank, and you've got a lot of boxing. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's DAZN. DAZN.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
Like it's DAZN, but it's DAZN. For HBO leaving it, I think it's a big whoop because, like we say, there's a lot of other platforms and areas that are showing boxing. Showtime is increasing their boxing commitment. Personally, I don't get it because I don't even want to watch football anymore, much less boxing, in terms of knowing the impact. It is not a sport you can play safely.
Right. Well,
and I just can't enjoy it knowing what they're going to look like in 20 years.
Well, and certainly with HBO, they got so burned by boxing when Mike Tyson was fighting. In fact, I was an intern, like a PA, during one of the Tyson fights in Atlantic City. And he knocked out, you know, it was one of those during the times in the 80s where he was knocking people out in the first round. Well, if you're HBO, you don't want that. You want people subscribing and then like sticking around for like, you know, 12 round fight, you know, an exciting fight. And I just happened to be in the control truck when, you know, he knocked out I can't even remember what fight it was. He knocked the person out in 90 seconds and literally all the HBO executives were yelling, "Get up, get up." Because well, they were like, "Not again."
Well, you can't control live sports. Some games, Super Bowls, are going to be boring. Some Wimbledon finals are going to be dull. There's nothing you can do about that. But I just think there's so many new competitors, people bidding more money, their audience, they just don't need it anymore. Kind of the way they've drifted away from live comedy.
Right. Recently, we talked about a German production of Ibsen's play Enemy of the People that was censored by the Chinese government. Why? Because they know the soft power of entertainment can be very influential. Case in point, Kinky Boots. The smash hit Broadway musical has been packing them in across China of all places, encouraging drag queens, and thus those who identify as or support queers, to step into the spotlight a little more confidently. It's also the first stage musical to include sign language interpreters for the hearing impaired. In China, a same-gender sexual orientation was decriminalized in 1997. In fact, that's 6 years before the U.S. Supreme Court essentially did the same thing in Lawrence v. Texas, and they did that in 2003, by the way.
Yeah, so we shouldn't get a little superior here, not right. Necessarily.
In China, it was removed from a list of mental illnesses in 2001. In that case, by the way, the U.S. did better since the APA did that back in 1973. In any case, it's groundbreaking and influencing people in countless ways. So, Michael, are you a heartless bastard or will you admit that this is a big deal?
Well, I'm a heartless bastard. I don't think it's a big deal, but it's a great little small step. That's why it's a big whoop. But I'm fascinated by the fact that they're doing sign language. That's great. That's very cool to see. And by the way, speaking of Kinky Boots, the Broadway edition will be closing in April of 2019. At that point, it will be the 25th longest running show in Broadway history. That's with 6 years running on Broadway because it opened in April of 2013. And boy, did I not see that coming at all.
Neither did Cyndi Lauper.
She might have. She's a confident woman, and I love her. She's great.
Yes, I think she probably thought, oh, this will be a nice 2 years.
But everybody say yeah. It's a horrible, horrible song in the show. Everybody say yeah. Everybody say yeah. And then there's a key change. Everybody say yeah. It's like, oh, my God. This is not a good song. Anyway.
No,
someday we're going to have an entirely musical version of our Showbiz Sandbox. We're going to have a musical episode, just like Buffy.
Well, I will actually be absent that day.
I don't mind.
When you work for Disney, you're not an employee. In fact, you are a cast member. And by the way, it's the Disney theme parks. Unfortunately for many theme park employees, they've been cast in a Dickensian. I can never say that word properly. It's a Dickensian nightmare that they've been cast in, filled with long hours and low wages. A lengthy expose on the Topic website is the latest body blow to the company's image as a family-friendly and positive park. Employees sleeping in cars, afraid to take breaks, struggling to get by on minimal wage, while head Mouseketeers Bob Iger, he's set to take home more than $400 million in the next 4 years. What would Jiminy Cricket say?
I don't know, kidding.
Yeah. And what does Michael say? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, this particular article, I guess, is a big whoop, but every piece of the puzzle that comes into focus just lets you increase the pressure on Disney to start paying their employees a decent wage. They make a lot of money. There's no excuse.
You know, when I was leaving Coachella this year, I happened to be in front of a bunch of Disney theme park employees. They were all teenagers, right? And they were all, we're just all walking out to our cars. And I was just listening to them, you know. Yes, I was eavesdropping, okay? If you really want to know the truth.
Pervy older man.
I was more interested in the economic, socioeconomic issues going on. That sounds kind of, I probably should have been the pervy older man. But instead, I was trying to hear, like, okay, so what do they think of working there? And they were all talking about how much fun they had and the struggles of working on this roller coaster versus that ride, you know, and it was more like operational issues, not about the finances. Mind you, they were all probably 18, 19, 20 years old. There's a big difference between being that age and being 35 to 45 years old and living in your car because you can't afford to live while working on teenage wages.
Well, two things. One is that the topic article is fascinating because a lot of these employees who talk about these struggles love their job. They love it. They love it. They're living in a car and they still enjoy coming to work and doing this stuff. So that's just fascinating to hear how much they really love their work and enjoy being there. But let's keep clear. The vast majority of people who make minimum wage are not pimply-faced 16-year-olds who are just doing it for fun and to learn things. No, no, no. The vast majority of minimum wage are their primary or their sole household earners. You know, so people depend on them, even if they live alone. The idea that minimum wage people are all kids who are just, you know, don't really need the money. It's just for fun. That's not true when you look at the real world. And it's certainly not true of employees of a Disney theme park who've been there for 10 years, you know.
Right. In one of the more obvious mergers of the year, the satellite radio company Sirius XM is buying the streaming radio company Pandora with an all-stock bid valued at $3.5 billion. Pandora has been hit hard by on-demand streaming sites like Spotify, and now offer a similar service, albeit with only 6 million paid subscribers. However, it also reaches 70 million monthly users with its freemium radio platform. Sirius has a subscriber base of 36 million, though 23 million are trial listeners, so that should tell you something. And those trial listeners typically get access for a year after buying a car with Sirius XM installed. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, who knows? Because this was announced the day we recorded our last episode.
That's right, yeah.
On September 24th, unless we recorded on a Sunday. Did we record on Sunday or Monday that time?
I think we recorded on Sunday.
So it was announced the day after that we recorded our show, but it's been in the news for 2 weeks. So we're both like, did we talk about this? I can't remember.
Right.
So we're trying to figure out if we covered this always. So we're just going to say, yeah, that happened. It does seem very obvious. It makes perfect sense. There you go.
Right. And I think they already owned a certain portion of Pandora. So they're just paying up for the rest of their stake.
And another deal just happened. And that one, I don't get at all. It really wasn't the way I expected. Fox, after all the shenanigans, they're selling their stake in Sky, which they lost a bid on, to Comcast. Comcast beat out Fox to get the right to own Sky. And now Fox is selling their piece of Sky to Comcast for a pure cash deal of $15 billion. We all thought there would be horse trading or, you know, TV stations or something would go on like that. But no, it was just a straight up sale.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Disney didn't want, like, they know that they're already facing pushback trying to buy Fox, okay? They know that that's happening. And so then maybe they just said, you know what, we don't want all of Hulu because that will just prove to people that we're trying to be, you know, dominate the market. Let's just take the cash, lower the cost of buying Fox, and move on.
All right.
London is a really expensive place to live. One easy way to think of it is that London and New York have the same prices. But New York's are in dollars, and London's are in pounds. Since New York City is really expensive too, that means most of London is 30 to 40% more expensive than the Big Apple. One exception is theater. Savvy theater goers know that London theater is much more accessible. Heck, you can even call the box office, which good luck trying to do that in the U.S. And tickets aren't so crazy. And perhaps the best deal of all are the subsidized tickets at the National Theater, which are made available to the public thanks to a sponsorship from TravelX. Unfortunately, after 15 years, TravelX is walking away from that deal. Some 3 million people, including my co-host Michael, in fact, have attended...
Hey, that's me.
Yeah, you've attended performances of more than 70 different productions thanks to this program. Well, maybe not you personally, but certain, you know, at the National Theater, TravelX sponsored 70 different productions. The National insists it will find a new sponsor, but fans can't help being a little nervous until one is announced. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm going to say a big whoop because I'm going to just assume they do get a new sponsor. Here in New York, the closest equivalent is the Signature Theater Company, which has a big partnership with Time Warner Cable, and that keeps their ticket prices for really good off-Broadway productions at $40 when you subscribe, and that's bargain rate. So, you know, the 15-pound deals at the National are awesome. I have done it. That's like 4 to 5 shows a year over the past 15 years. They've helped subsidize and make lots of tickets available to people. You see a lot more young people at those productions. When you talk about getting the future of Broadway, the way Sperling always talks about getting the future of Hollywood, you want people to get in the habit of going to the movies at a young age? Well, the National does that with these really inexpensive tickets. It really works. I love it, and I hope it continues.
Everyone has been warily eyeing Apple and its plans to move into programming. They've got the money, the product base, and the hip factor to take on Netflix and HBO and, well, just about everyone making movies with an iPhone. Well, that desire to be a big player just took a hit. One of the first projects Apple announced was based on the life of Apple exec Dr. Dre, and it was dubbed Vital Signs. It was semi-autobiographical and highly anticipated. That was until Applehead Tim Cook watched it, at least according to the Wall Street Journal. Vital Signs showed people doing lines of cocaine, orgies, and gun violence. What the f***? said Cook. We can't show this. It's too violent. And that was a project close to the heart of one of their top executives. In fact, it was about one of their top executives. That makes the chance of an outsider getting something edgy past Cook seem vanishingly small. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to say it's kind of a big deal. I mean, I guess they can flourish as a Disney-type family-friendly platform, but... You know, that's crazy. What the hell did you expect making a show about the life of a hip-hop producer? You know, it's just kind of ridiculous that they greenlit a show about Dr. Dre, one of their executives, and he's like, what? Drugs, sex, violence? I can't believe it. I mean, didn't anyone read the scripts? Didn't anyone pay attention to the production? That's just, were they expecting the Jonas Brothers and Purity Rings? I mean, that's incompetence. Like, how little attention they paid to the show, and then they pull the plug. Like, why haven't they shopped it around to someone else? Why are they sitting on it? Let someone else show it, unless it's just so bad and they're trying to pretend that it's because of the sex and violence. But to me, it just seems unconscionable. Like, do you not know what shows you're making? Did nobody read the scripts? What's going on here? That's just ridiculous.
A lot of people are saying that about Apple, by the way. You know, like, who's running the show over there?
Well, Apple's making lots of money, but, you know, Apple's not...
No,
Apple's,
sorry. I mean Apple in terms of getting into content. Sorry, I should have clarified.
Right. Well, there you go. So that's just another example. Do I want to go do business somewhere where they just seem to be clueless and have their head in the sands and then wait until the thing is actually done before they go, oh, wait a second, what is this? I mean, Nothing about this is a surprise. So that's really, really bad, and they need to fix that. But I have to say, the Wall Street Journal had a story about this, and it's paywalled, so you can't really read it, but I love their headline. It says, no sex please, we're Apple, which is a classic British farce. No sex please, we're British. So good headline, whoever did that.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. We've got a music roundup this week. First, Ticketmaster has responded to a letter from Senate investigators who would like a little more information about that ticket scalping story in the Canadian press and, more importantly, why they can't get seats to see Springsteen on Broadway. I'd like to know that too. Then we've got three different acts who have debuted at number one on the album charts, all with a story to tell. The Gershwin Prize was announced. They announced the latest recipient of its songwriting honor. And I know, Michael, you are just not pleased at all. Finally, the Recording Industry Association of America is making like the Oscars and inviting a lot of new members. But will it help? I don't know. So Ticketmaster, let's start there, Michael. you know, really, it's kind of self-explanatory.
Right. Nothing much happened here, except Congress is paying attention. And they said, hello. And they sent a letter. And Ticketmaster said, we can't believe this is happening. We are shocked over the abuse of our system that is set up to facilitate scalping. I mean, it's set up to block scalping. So Basically, this is more to come. Congress is looking at it. Ticketmaster has made harumphing noises that they can't believe this has been going on, even though it came from their own people and involves their own website. So we'll have to see where we end up. But this is not done yet. We got a lot more to do.
Well, then, okay, there are three different albums that debuted at the top of the Billboard charts since we last spoke, Michael. First, there's Carrie Underwood. She had her fourth number 12 album, making her the first female country act to take four albums to the top ever. Plus, she had the biggest week of the year for any woman so far. Then the hip-hop collective Brockhampton hit number one, making them the first rap act and one of the few acts in history to top the charts with an openly gay artist as the lead performer. And finally, Lil Wayne debuted at the top with the second biggest streaming week of all time after Drake. So these are all different chart toppers, different stories, different reasons why.
So Carrie Underwood, that's very cool. I immediately thought, what about Dolly Parton? What about that? And I looked. Not only is she the first female country act to do this, she's one of the few country acts ever. When I started looking up men you think might have done it, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, blah, blah, you know, Randy Travis, Alabama, no. Garth Brooks is the only one I can find.
Wait, did she have the number one album, Carrie Underwood?
Yes.
Or the
yes.
number, because I think I said number 12 album.
Well, you misspoke or I mistyped. No, she had her fourth number one album on the top of the Billboard charts.
Got it.
It's all about number one albums.
I was wondering. I was like, how does that work? Number 12 album?
Sorry. So Garth Brooks had 9 number one albums, including 5 studio albums. Willie Nelson never topped the charts. Johnny Cash had 2. One way back early in his days with Live at San Quentin, and then another one with American 5 towards the end. Kenny Rogers, just 1. Dolly Parton, never done it. So, you know, this is not an easy thing for anyone to do, to have 4 number one albums. She may be the second country act. Forget women. She may just be the second country act of all time to do this. So that's very, very cool. Brockhampton, I'm very excited. Kevin Abstract is openly gay. They talk about it a lot in the lyrics. It's not like something that's known, but they never discuss. They're very queer positive. It's a weird hip-hop boy band collective. I love everything that they do. They're cool guys. So that's very fun to see. And, you know, one of the few acts to ever do it, certainly the first act this year, but only because the lead of Panic at the Disco came out as sexually fluid after his album hit number one. So, you know, he was just a few weeks late in making him the first act of the year to do that. So that's really a sign of the times. And then Lil Wayne, you know, even 5 years off, when you look at hip hop right now, everybody has to release a song, an EP, a live thing, a track. I mean, Drake, it never ends. You know, these people, it's a constant stream of music. Lil Wayne took 5 years off between albums. So that's kind of a different thing. And people waited and they were excited. And so there you go. So that doesn't have to be all done in the same way. Not that he didn't appear as a guest star on a lot of other people, but a lot of activity on the charts, a lot of positive stories to tell.
Well, here's a story. You should get on your feet, Michael. You know why?
Get on your feet.
Well, because the rhythm is going to get you, you know, when I announced that Gloria and Emilio Estefan are the next recipients of the Gershwin Songwriting Prize. They are the first couple and the first people of Latino descent to be so honored. They join the likes of Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder, Paul McCartney, Billy Joel, Willie Nelson, and Carole King to win
exactly,
such a prestigious prize.
Exactly. They are joining Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder, Paul McCartney, Billy Joel, Willie Nelson, Carole King. I'm from South Florida. I like The Rhythm Is Gonna Get You. They have some cool songs. I was happy to see their Broadway show. It was actually a little bit better than I expected. It ended with conga and we all danced in the aisles. But this is ridiculous. I mean, I'm sorry. If you want Latinx people or more women, there are many other ways to go. Starting with, as I mentioned before, Dolly Parton. You know, Dolly Parton is one of the great songwriters of all time. If you feel like you need more women, and you do, Dolly Parton. Bacharach and David, Tony Bennett, Smokey Robinson. If you want Latinx people, Joan Gilberto, Cayetana Veloso, Celia Cruz. Well, she's dead, actually, so I don't think they only want living people. But Ruben Blades. I mean, there are just a lot of Latinx artists who have a much more important body of work. than Gloria and Emilio Estefan. I don't wish them ill. They seem like lovely people, but this is just absurd. And it really, to me, lowers the importance of the Gershwin Prize. They've only given it to like 8 people. And now this. To me, it's a joke.
Well, then I guess let me ask you this, because it kind of leads to our next story. The Grammys are getting serious about diversification. And just like the group behind the Oscars, the Recording Academy knows it needs to diversify to reflect the actual people that make the music that powers their success. So following recommendations, they've invited 900 new members, all of whom check off a box. They are women and or people of color and or under 39 years old. Further, the nominating panels that make the shorts lists for major categories have also been diversified, reaching 51% female and 48% people of color. That's a big jump, by the way, from last year when women made up 28% of the panels and people of color were 37%.
So I mean, they almost doubled the number of women on the panels. And 50% increase practically for people of color, maybe 30%. I suppose that's fairer. But wow, that is a big jump in representation on the shortlist panel. So that's a very important step. Well, you know, I think they need to have standards. And Gloria and Emilio Estefan obviously are members of and should be members of the RIAA. You know, that's appropriate. You want diversity. But when you're looking at diversity for the greatest songwriters of all time, I just don't think they're there. So I think this is great. I think it's important. It's a 7% increase in their voting membership. You know what? It takes a long haul to really make the membership reflect the music that's being created by professionals and the audience that it's being made for. This is a good first step, but it's far from the last one.
Speaking of last steps.
It's time for the obit section.
That's correct. Me,
and by the way, somebody just died. I noticed in our emails.
You mean like right now after my bad joke?
Arnold Copelson, the Oscar-winning producer of Platoon, who also did The Fugitive, died at 83. So that just happened while we were recording our show.
And he's been in the news recently. Do you know why he's been in the news?
Why is that?
Because he was on the board of CBS, okay? Oh. And he was the person who said, Les Moonves is our guy. We're not switching horses.
Well, that's a bad little coda for him, but he does have some important good movies, and hopefully in his personal life was a well-behaved man. I assume he was. No reason not to think that. But he is a producer who did some important work. Another producer who died, I would just jump to because I wasn't even sure. I mean, Gary Kurtz. If you love Star Wars, you love Gary Kurtz because he's linked arm in arm with George Lucas. Other than that, he really didn't do anything important. But you know what? Working on the Star Wars franchise, I guess, is kind of a lifetime project. He died at 78, and nothing to be ashamed of. You know, you're linked to one of the biggest hits of all time, one of the biggest franchises. That's pretty cool.
Well, somebody who's linked to a lot of big names and big albums is Jeff Emerick. He was the engineer for the Beatles. He died at the age of 72. He started at Abbey Road when he was 15 years old. He was the assistant engineer on Love Me Do and other early songs. Of course, George Martin was the producer on some of those songs. And he engineered alongside him for Revolver and Sgt. Pepper at the White Album. He did partial work on that. I think, did he do Abbey Road? I guess he won a Grammy for Abbey Road, right?
He won a Grammy for Sgt. Pepper and Abbey Road, one of the great engineers of all time, died at 72. Always seen as Paul's guy. So he didn't work on the solo stuff for John or George, but he did work on Paul's albums like Band on the Run and Tug of War and Flaming Pie, but those two are great albums. He also worked on the Zombies album, Odyssey and Oracle.
And Imperial Bedroom, the Elvis Costello album, that's a really good album.
Yeah, and Odyssey as an Oracle is a masterpiece as well. If you probably know the song, The Time of the Season. You know, it's in a lot of movies, and that whole album is tremendous and hugely influential. But yeah, a landmark Elvis Costello album. He worked on the demos for Kate Bush, who is a really important artist. And he even worked on Nellie Mackay, worked on her debut album right up to a 2015 album of covers of 1960s songs. So working right up to the end. So he was a prickly bastard. I think that's a given. His biography, some people take issue with about his perspective on things, but an important engineer. It's too bad he never worked with Charles Aznavour.
Yeah, Charles Aznavour. I mean, if the name sounds familiar, it's because he's a legend. He's a legend. Yeah, he's a French-Armenian singer. He died at the age of 94. He was very short at 5'3" tall, and so he was dubbed Le Petit Charles. but he wrote like 1,000 songs and sold 150 to 200 million records. And, you know, I guess we...
That's probably singles as well as exactly. albums. Yeah.
And he did more than 60 films, including... Francois Truffaut's Shoot the Piano Player, and he often toured with, in the U.S. at least, with Liza Minnelli, and he could not be more French. you know, I actually saw Charles Aznavour perform in the 1980s.
I'm jealous.
I was very, very young, and I saw him at Carnegie Hall. I didn't really understand what
I
was
seeing. You saw the Carnegie Hall show? Very funny. What the hell? Why did your parents bring you? Or what happened?
I don't know. I have no idea. I just remember going to that, and it was the first time I had ever been in Carnegie Hall. And
why isn't he singing in English, you wondered?
Yeah, I was like, am I supposed to understand like what's going on here? I have no idea why I was there.
Did you like it, or did you not? Were you old enough to even like it?
I do remember it, but it's vague memories, like just not like images more than
sounds.
Well,
he toured right up to the end, so you know, right up to a few years ago. So I blew my chance to see him. The Prime Minister of France called him profoundly French. Wow, that's brilliant. And I love this anecdote. It doesn't get more French than this. When Edith Piaf rejected one of Charles Aznavour's songs, specifically I Hate Sundays, he gave it to Juliette Gréco, then the darling of the left-bank philosophers and their acolytes. When Piaf changed her mind, she was enraged to find that she'd lost the song. And according to Francois Lévy, one of her biographers, she confronted Charles Aznavour and said, "What? You gave it to that existentialist?" That is as French as it gets. Edith Piaf, Charles Aznavour, existentialism. My goodness.
1960s, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And winding up with music, Marty Balin, the co-founder of the Jefferson Airplane, died at 76, a great singer, right alongside Grace Slick. So that's an important band in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, and finally, Will Vinton. He was an Oscar and Emmy-winning animator. If you're into animation at all, you know who Will Vinton is. He is extremely... he was a legend. He created a lot of claymation. In fact, he did the I Heard It Through the Grapevine, the California Raisins ad. He won an Oscar for Closed Mondays. He worked on Return to Oz. He worked on a show with Eddie Murphy, the television show called The PJs. And I'm trying to remember if he did I don't think he did the cars and the Chevron commercials, but he is known for that kind of stop motion work.
Yeah, that's his signature. I mean, he dubbed it claymation. He's the guy who came up with the name. I mean, it's his shtick. So he's cool. And he worked with early talent. I mean, people came to Portland, cause that became a destination for animation. They would do TV commercials like the California Raisins and Domino's Pizza Noid, which I totally forgot about until I read his, obituary. He died at 70, but James Mangold, Gus Van Sant, both got early starts doing stuff on commercials and things that he was working on. So that's cool. He was so popular at one point that Michael Jackson said, "I want a claymation character." And he created one just for Michael Jackson. But a cool, interesting career. And he came up just a few months ago, cause we were talking about, has another TV commercial ever been turned into a film the way that basketball commercial about old men playing basketball got turned into a movie. The closest we came was the California Raisins, who got their own TV specials and won Emmys in the process. So
yes, that's right.
A cool, fascinating career for Will Vinton.
Well, that wraps up our show for this week. And remember, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And we do ask that you rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, along with links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, we're on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week, the website is nosexpleasewe'repodcasters.com.
Wait a second, I do not endorse that that website.
I was thinking of Le Petit Sperling or Le Petit Michel, so be glad I chose that one.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Or, of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to find out what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.
Okay, I was thinking of ending the show with a performance of Somewhere from West Side Story just to prove how wrong Steven Spielberg was. What do you think?
I think the police are coming for you right now.
There's a play. Oh, damn it.